From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour goes back to the year 1566, 20 years after the death of Martin Luther. A book of his sayings called Table Talk was published by Luther's note-taker. The book includes the story of a 12-year-old boy who, based on modern diagnosis, might well have had autism in a more severe manner, you might say. He had trouble communicating, and according to the note-taker, Martin Luther didn't understand, even writing that he thought the boy might have been possessed by the devil. Luther even suggested the boy be suffocated. Well, in recent years, there's some doubt over whether this really happened, but one thing is clear. For hundreds, if not thousands of years, autism has been misunderstood badly. That is changing. Fortunately, in this hour, we look at the potential of people with autism. We look at our expectations for them, their successes when it comes to school, work, and relationships. And we look at how our expectations could limit people with autism unnecessarily. Our guests in studio are doing some great work in this field, professors at Nazareth College and the co-directors of the Interdisciplinary Specialty Program in Autism at Nazareth. That's Shana Jamanis and Don Vogler Elias. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having us.
And we also have on the line with us someone that they know well, a student by the name of William Evans, who is, William, first of all, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
You're in Buffalo, is that right, William?
Yes, that is correct.
And in school at, is it Canisius?
Yes, Canisius College.
Well, very good. Don, Shana, tell us a little bit about how you know William.
Well, we were first introduced to William through a colleague of mine who works at the Advocacy Center. William completed a program called Partners in Policymaking, and my colleague knew that Shana and I were starting this program, and she connected William with us, and we've had lots of wonderful conversations and dialogue with William about his work as a self-advocate, identifying as someone on the autism spectrum. He's given us lots of insight into our programming and how we engage with students who will be future professionals supporting individuals on the autism spectrum. He's Skyped with our classes. We've been to Buffalo to meet with him, and we really appreciate his insight on autism.
Well, we look forward to conversing with all of you this hour. This program, part of our Move to Include series, and our thanks to the Golisano Foundation for their partnership with WXXI as we seek to include voices in all parts of our community, focusing on their strengths, the positive impacts, and what we all can learn as we move to include. That's what we're doing this hour as we talk about autism. Now, I want to start with something
later.
Kind of an interesting thing here. William, can I ask you, you are someone with autism, or do you refer to yourself as autistic?
I refer to myself as autistic just because it's more accurate. When we talk about a person as autistic, what it does is it identifies that the autistic traits, or the cluster of traits we call autism, are a non-negotiable aspect of their identity. And if you were to neurologically change them and take away those autistic traits, which are thoroughly based in the brain, in the nervous system, even just biochemically, you would fundamentally alter the person's experiences of the world, the person's understanding of the world, and the person's sort of conception of who they are and how they perceive information. It's similar to this. We don't talk about a Christian as a person with Christianity, because that would be absurd. We talk about a Christian as a Christian, or a Muslim as a Muslim, or a Jew as a Jew, et cetera, et cetera. And the logic is quite similar. I think that many people who are offended by autistic person misunderstand this concept, and I think misunderstand sort of autistic traits, either because they've been contaminated by autism speaks, or they simply are just not well-read.
Well, first of all, William, and again, I know we've had the folks from Autism Speaks on, and everyone, I think, is working towards similar goals, which is the best life outcomes for everybody. There's no question about that. I find this very interesting, and let me ask Shana the question here, because I'm hearing William describe this, and he's saying, look, it's part of identity, that we don't need to sugarcoat it. At the same time, there are those who say, if you refer to someone as an autistic person, it is overly limiting, you know, and so for those of us in the media and for those of us in society, we want to do right by autistic people and people with autism. I don't want to offend. I want to be as constructive as I can be. So I'm really moved by William's comments, but I also hear people on the other side.
Well, I think that the folks that it's very ingrained within a professional field to use person first language. It's part of the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, and that came about so that we would treat people as people versus thinking about them only by their disability. However, I think that it's really important that we listen to the voices of individuals on the autism spectrum thinking about autism differently. And so for it, someone who is autistic, it's, as William said, it's a part of who they are. It's how their brain works. It's how they see the world. It's how they interact. And you can't separate that out. And by saying someone with autism, it insinuates that somehow we're separating that out. It is very difficult, though, for many of us in the professional arena to sometimes use the term autistic individual, and William and I have had this conversation, because we are so ingrained and entrenched in this idea that we are supposed to be thinking about a person first, which in reality, as many individuals on the autism spectrum tell us, you should be doing that anyway, regardless of the language you use. However, language can be very powerful, and I think it is something that it's important we listen to the culture of autism, the autistic community here as well, and include that voice, which hasn't always been included in this conversation.
I have no doubt that occasionally you do find people who are offended by certain terminology, right?
Yes. You know, yes.
And so, William, my understanding is are you studying law?
I am. Well, I'm a history major. And the goal is to go to law school in a couple of years.
Okay. And so, you know, again, eventually I think we're probably going to be talking about the lawyer, William Evans, who is autistic, or however you want to self-describe. But even if we use the language that William is autistic or however, if you want to use that kind of description, that doesn't change the fact that he could also be a lawyer, or he is a student, or he could be a father, or whatever those things are. That it's not limiting, I hope.
No.
Right, William?
No, it's not limiting, but it, when we talk about an autistic person as an autistic person, as diverse as we are in terms of our specific traits or our interests or our life outcomes, in terms of some of us do reach it to marriage or parenthood or whatnot, autistic simply entails fundamental core traits and fundamental core understanding of the world and perceptions of the world. It's not in any way, quote unquote, limiting. It's just, it just simply signifies that this collection of traits we call autism is a critical part of the person's just very, very being as a human. I mean, it does no more than that.
And I think if I can elaborate on that, William, because I think what you're saying is so important and it's so eloquent, is that the autistic traits, many individuals in the autism community feel are strengths and assets. And so rather than using the terminology like person with cancer, person with a disease, person with autism, this flips that story a little bit and highlights things about the autistic community that they appreciate about themselves. And so thinking about just those traits and assets as a strength and in that way changes it too.
Is it fair to say, you know, if my stepfather has cancer, we say he has cancer because you hope that it is going to be changed or cured or eliminated. Someone who is autistic, that is who they are. And let me ask Dawn and Shayna to update us. I mean, for years we heard questions on, for lack of a better word, a cure, or et cetera, et cetera. Where is the sort of the thinking in that field now?
There still is some conversation, you know, certain groups sort of have an agenda of, is there a cure to autism? Can we, you know, maybe some interventions have a goal of making individuals or children on the autism spectrum appear less autistic, if you will, or, you know, changing what they're doing to kind of fit them into what we perceive as normal. And I think something that we really emphasize in our program, preparing future educators and speech language pathologists, is thinking about how we can just flip that a little bit. And instead of the goal being trying to change an individual, how can we provide supports, accommodations,
reduce barriers,
allow individuals to access resources that will allow them to do what they want to do and what their family wants them to do and have a meaningful life and a happy life. And it doesn't necessarily have to mean that that life is exactly the way every other child, you know, in the classroom is experiencing the classroom. It could be different, but it's not, the goal isn't to remove the autism.
We're talking about autism this hour with the co-directors of the Interdisciplinary Specialty Program in Autism at Nazareth College. That's Shana Jimanis and Don Vogler Elias. William Evans is on the line with us. He is a student at Canisius, a history major who's moving into law, and he is autistic. He's on the line with us as well. Let me get to Bonnie, who is on line one, wants to join the conversation as we talk about ways we label people and, you know, right or wrong. Go ahead, Bonnie.
Yeah. Well, I really appreciate what your guests are saying about the nature of, in this case, we're talking about autistic characteristics of the person that they see. That's how they see the world, and that's who they are. I'm used to using the word person with myself, and I don't, in my mind, when I hear the two, I don't hear a difference in my own mind, but I respect the fact that the person that's involved here is saying that they want to have it as a more of a descriptor, as for the reasons they gave. The reason I'm calling, though, is the reason to spend time on this a little bit is because I'm just defensive. I am so sick and tired of hearing disability spoken in so many different, you know, people kind of challenge themselves so they don't have to really deal with it, that there is a disability. And so the way to cover that you're even talking about it is to use words like, we're challenged, or I'm this, or I'm that. And I just want to raise a banner to say, stop it. Because there's, you know, I think a lot of it's because we are ashamed. We are embarrassed about talking about disabilities or any, you know, just like race or class or any of these things. We're not comfortable. So the way we think we have to kind of, well, am I going to hurt your feelings? Oh, my God. People mostly want to be identified with who they are and what they think of themselves. And how they, as he was saying, they perceive the world. You know, that's just a good thing to know how people perceive the world differently without having to hide. Well, there is a name for some of this that I'm seeing differently. So you shouldn't have to hide that. That's my comment.
Thank you, Bonnie. What do you think, Dawn?
I think that an important thing to consider is that for many groups of individuals with various disabilities or labels or who identify as autistic or otherwise, there are many barriers in schools, in society, in our communities that make the way that they experience the world, which may be different than typical individuals, very challenging. And so I think we really need to listen to individuals and identify that there are things outside of that person's control that make the world sometimes challenging to access and difficult to engage with. I don't know if that responds to her question.
Yeah,
exactly,
I mean, I think that the idea, I think she's actually, I mean, she's spot on with, mm-hmm. with much of the stuff, you know, information that she was sharing, and that it would be great if we could allow individuals to express themselves and be free to do that. And unfortunately, for most individuals on the autism spectrum, they haven't been able to do that in ways because there have been so many barriers. And there have been, you know, there's a definite idea of what normal is considered to be. And individuals on the autism spectrum are often on the periphery, sort of looking in and trying to figure out how to break into that box of normal.
Well, and normal, I think, is also a bit of a loaded word.
Yes, it is.
You know, and prevalence of autism is now 1 in, is it 60?
68.
68. Mm-hmm. 1 in 68. It wasn't long ago. It was 1 in 88. And that was after it was 1 in 100. And before that, it was 1 in 150. Are we leveling off now? Do we think that we've got a good idea for what the spectrum includes in terms of prevalence, or is it going to be 1 in 50 eventually? Is it going to be 1 in 25?
I don't know that we really know the answer to that. I think that there are many reasons why the prevalence rate has dropped, one being that we are much better at identifying autism now. If you look at rates of, say, childhood schizophrenia back in the 50s, those were much higher because we didn't really know what autism was. We didn't really have a word for it. So now we do, and now we've got an autism spectrum disorder. And again, normal is a loaded word, but that is the word that is used oftentimes. If you look at diagnostic criteria for individuals on the autism spectrum, there are words like abnormal, deviant, or unusual. Yeah. I mean, these are words that are used to describe and identify individuals.
Okay. Well, from my perspective, I would think that a diagnosis of autism, while maybe in those initial stages, especially for parents, can be a little scary at times, it's also tremendously empowering because you get an idea for what's going on, and then you start to identify individual characteristics and behavior, et cetera. And let me ask William. I mean, William, you are, first of all, Dawn and Shana really talked you up before we came on this program, and so far you've really delivered. I mean, you're a very impressive young man, and you're someone who's also very self-aware and has looked into autism in very serious ways. I've met people who didn't get a diagnosis until they were almost 30, and for those of us around them, it was almost heartbreaking to think 3 decades without a real good idea of why certain interpersonal relationships often struggled or those kind of things. So let me ask you, with your own understanding of your autism, what are your challenges that stand out on a day-to-day basis for you? I don't know if that's the right question, but I'll start there with you.
First of all, I think that what you're aiming at is good. I think that the wording is a little bit a little bit offbeat, but yeah. I think that first of all, just honestly about the whole normal thing, the word that often you might hear is the word neurotypical, and it's basically a generic word for people who are either not autistic, which is what it meant in its original version, and it also just means people whose cognitive and social development are basically within the general patterns. I mean, maybe they use the word normal, but a better word would be atypical, and that is that it's just that neurologically speaking, the development is a little bit off, is delayed or off beat in some ways. I mean, that really is basically what it means. And in terms, I think that some of the challenges, I think that most of the challenges we face are only equivalent to the environment in which we live. I mean, I think that the first challenge is finding an environment, just like anybody, which suits my needs. I mean, for example, I often need an environment that's quiet where I can study and be by myself if I'm trying to get things done. Because for me, socializing and getting work done generally are almost never mix. I mean, if I'm going to socialize, I'm going to socialize. If I'm going to get work done, I'm going to get work done. And there really can't be any overlap because I just won't get anything done. And I think that for parents, autistic, sort of the idea that a child is autistic, and again, I'm going to use that phrase just because it's just factual. It simply is more accurate to the reality. That is scary, really, only if the parent does not have a genuine understanding of what autistic, of the cluster of traits that we call autism, or sort of the autistic population, or if they don't have, or if they don't know of the resources that exist for the autistic community, or by the autistic community, for other members of the autistic community, such as websites, blogs, Facebook pages, outright organizations that have been around for probably 20 years. And well, once, and I've seen this, once parents understand that those exist, those resources exist, then it's not so scary, I think. And I just think the fear, because I think just like with anything, I think that fear often comes, and it's not just the autistic community. Fear comes from often ignorance, not knowing about something, not understanding something. I mean, it's really, in a sense, it's fear of the unknown. And I think that for one of the challenges I face is that I'll be honest with you. I think that I've been told that I have a chip on my shoulder sometimes. And, you know, even if people aren't being judgmental, there I have an assumption that people are, because I often get this look of, you're not normal. And it sometimes is comical, but sometimes it's not. And so feeling a need to communicate is something that I deal with, because oftentimes I do misjudge people and that they're really not hung up on how eccentric I am when they interact with me, or they're not hung up on how atypical I appear, even though I kind of jump to that. And I think that, I think those are pretty common because of what we hear growing up, which is that, in order to get ahead in life, you have to mimic socially sort of acceptable behavior, again, which is factually true. I mean, you have to basically look like a neurotypical in order to get what you want. And I'd say at this point, that's true probably 95% of the time. And so making sure that some of my oddities don't come out sometimes is very difficult. So, for example, I will talk about how, and Don knows this, how I ride my bike everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, Don, you know that, right?
Yes, I do. Yep.
And how I rode my bike to Rochester and back to Buffalo. And for most people, they looked at me like I was crazy. I mean, I did it in fun. I mean,
I'm just impressed. I don't think you're crazy. I find that very impressive, William.
Thank you. I'm saying that that sort of behavior, another thing would be making sure that I have a car, which I just got recently. And that way, because, again, when I've experienced this, when I go to a social outing and I have to arrive 45 minutes early to shower, clean up, because I bike 2 hours to get there, you know, there's a sense of deviancy and a sense of, oh, wait, I'm here because I need information, or I want a job, or I need a promotion, or I need information, or I need somebody's support. And there's always the question of, you know, are they going to hold the fact that I'm a little bit deviant against me? And I mean, there's other ways too. I just think that for me is like, I mean, and it's a very common thing. You know, the autistic person who has extraordinary knowledge, extraordinary deep knowledge in one specific area. So it's often something in the hard sciences or engineering, but they don't have the interpersonal skills to make the connections or to get the job or even to hold down the job. And that, for me, has been a constant struggle.
Well,
in every job I've had, even if it was short-term and temporary, it's been there.
William has just given us so much to talk about, and I think what we ought to do is let's take a 60-second break, and then we're going to come back, and we're going to talk about expectations and the way they can be limiting and the way they perhaps should change for people who are autistic, like William. And then you heard him talk about the extraordinary skills or knowledge someone who is autistic might have, but the struggle in other areas, and then the question of when we train professionals, as Dawn and Shanna do, what kind of training is there to make sure some of the strengths and weaknesses are dealt with in ways that will help someone become as well-rounded as they can be. So really interesting stuff with Shanna Jimanis and Dawn Vogler-Elias, who are the co-directors of the Interdisciplinary Specialty Program in Autism at Nazareth College. William Evans is on the line with us. Short break, and then we answer some of those questions next on member-supported public radio. I'm Evan Dawson. Welcome back to Connections. And so impressed with William Evans, who's on the line with us from Buffalo. He is, William, how old are you? I didn't even ask you. I know you're a college student. How old are you?
24. I turned 24 at the end of March.
24. Talking about his life, his experiences as someone who is autistic. And William, let me ask you a question about expectations, because you mentioned, sure, you mentioned that when people meet you, there are certain things that they may judge about you. Is that, I don't know if you were talking about your own personal traits that they are trying to perceive, or is it because if they know that you are autistic, are they changing their expectations of you? So let me ask you, when people find out you are autistic, is there a risk that they will think of you differently in a way that is too limiting and unfair to you?
Absolutely. I think that, it's complicated because I often get the line of, I wouldn't guess you were autistic, or I get the line of, I didn't know you had autism, which again is I'm going over why that's inaccurate, but I think that sometimes, yes, I think that sometimes there's a sense of incredulity for certain people. I mean, people who are very well educated on this stuff, probably not, but I do run the risk. I mean, I do sometimes use it as a way to make fun of myself. I joke about myself. For example, I'm doing tonight I'm doing stand-up comedy at Canisius, and I'm doing an act called Neurologically Delinquent.
Neurologically Delinquent?
Yes, and it's kind of a way of making fun of myself and how we run into sort of social norms and how sometimes they don't always line up neatly. But, I mean, I do use it as sort of, I use it as sort of a source of comedy, honestly, because, quite honestly, I could write more than the Harry Potter books combined on miscommunication between the autistic population and typically developing individuals, because there are some general understandings that a typically developing individual has that autistic individuals don't, and there are some ways that we perceive the world that, you know, sort of maybe a typically developing person is not as likely to perceive. And again, that just has to do with the neurological machinery that is either present or missing on both sides of the, I call it the battle of the neurological variations. and I think that there's, I think with some people, but I think that I try to present it sometimes in a joking kind of, I'm a little quirky sort of way. I don't know how to present it as,
hold on, William. I got to jump in only because your cell phone's cutting out just for a second here. But again, he's given us so much to think about. And let me ask Don and Shana the question on expectations. He's saying that, yes, when people find out he's autistic, that there is a risk that they're going to think he is limited or incapable of certain things. Let's talk about expectations. We're getting better with this, Shana. I mean, I hope as a society we are, but there are a risk of limitations.
Yes, there are. And I think that we are getting better at it because we understand. And as I mentioned in my email to you with technology, people are now able to communicate in ways that they weren't before. So
give
they can tell us more about this. So there are a number of blogs and websites that are run by individuals who are nonverbal, who talk about what it means to be on the autism spectrum. And so I learn something new whenever I go into those blogs and read about why they might be interacting with their environment the way they are, or what they might be feeling. And it is really fascinating because it's very intellectual stuff. And we would never know that because they don't tell us that verbally. So I think William made so many good points when he talked about you know, his concern that people are going to judge him way back about 20 minutes ago, he talked about that. And that's very common for many individuals on the autism spectrum because they'll have experience after experience. And then they begin to assume that's the kind of experience they're going to have, right? That's human nature. So if that experience is that they've struggled making friends, they were rejected by children at a young age, they become adolescents and they begin to reject other kids. Now, part of what many people think is autism is that, oh, well, they just don't want to be friends. They want to isolate themselves. They want to be withdrawn. That's not true. I mean, you heard William say it. That's not true at all. That is because of repeated failure at that interaction because other people have rejected them. So I think that's something to be thinking about.
And I know, you, go ahead, William.
Actually, there's something called the social motivation hypothesis. And actually, sometimes there is repeated failure to make friends, repeated failure to establish relationships with other people. But at the same time, it's not absolutely every single case, but at an earlier age, maybe pre-adolescence, there is a general lack of interest in social interaction. There is it's not a conscious sort of I'm going to isolate myself sort of thing. It's more of a they're just not interested in interacting with other people. It's a neutral thing. And because their brain, we lack some of the cognitive machinery that can make social interaction rewarding for a typically developing person, and as a result, we don't interact. And the basic idea is the lack of the early social learning period from birth to maybe 5 or 6 years old is rapid in a typically developing person, the autistic population doesn't experience that because they're not interacting with other people. They're not looking. They're not engaging in nonverbal communication. They're not sort of social referencing, and as a result, the lack of that lack of social learning can come back to have enormous consequences later. And I mean, don't get me wrong. You know, there are plenty of autistic adolescents or adults who attempt to establish sort of relationship, business, romantic, whatever it is, and fail repeatedly and sort of give up after a while. I mean, that does happen. There's no question. But I'm saying that basically our own lack of interest sometimes, the lack of interest, just the general lack of social interest in interaction is almost universal. And oftentimes has dire consequences. And most of us, unless you really, really, really push us to interact with other people, are probably not going to interact until a much later age. So actually, yes, there's not a conscious choice of, oh, I'm going to isolate myself, but it just doesn't occur to us in the same way to enjoy interaction with other people.
Well, and Shana made us think about it, the notion of expectations, in that interesting way. Because if my expectation meeting someone who's autistic is they will be less capable of interpersonal relationships, they wouldn't be an effective friend or whatever it is, that's my expectation limiting their opportunity. But if their own experience is, I don't do well in groups. I don't have a lot of friends. Then the older they get, the more their own expectations are going to be injured by that. I guess that's interesting.
Yes, and also I think that what you brought up in your first point is really important because William's right. I mean, sure, that there are many individuals who just it doesn't occur to them to be interested. But our sort of reaction to that oftentimes as caregivers or people, you know, interacting with kids is that they don't want to or it's not being done in the right way. And then we begin to have expectations. And we talked about this in our class a few weeks ago when we thought about when you think about an individual on the autism spectrum who might be nonverbal, who might be self-injurious or aggressive, what are the expectations that people have of that individual? And nowhere in those expectations are jobs, are relationships. You know, people begin to see individuals as you know, they're not capable of that. And so as we think about some of those blogs and websites where people are talking about this, I think those are really interesting places to go to get more accurate information about what's going on.
Well, let me ask Shana and Dawn, and again, if you're just joining us, we're talking autism. It's part of our Move to Include series, and our thanks to the Golisano Foundation for partnering with WXXI. Throughout the year, we bring you programs that bring voices from all across our community, from all different backgrounds, as we seek to move to include, and it's our series that you can find more on WXXINews.org on that. We're talking autism today, and Shana and Dawn are here from Nazareth College, and their work, in some ways, works on preparing professionals. And when it comes to then expectations, let's say you've got someone, and William touched on this, Dawn, let's say you've got someone who is really talented or intellectually stimulated in one area. It's a bit of a caricature of autism, but in some ways it can be true. But as William said, you may have a great skill in one thing. Say it's engineering, but socially you're not very adept at handling communication, et cetera, et cetera. What is happening in terms of the way we work with people who are autistic that will improve that?
I think that we're shifting, you know, for several years, we had this sort of idea that if someone had this specialized interest or intense interest, unusual interest, that we maybe would try to limit that or, you know, direct them towards something else or kind of create interests that were more mainstream. And I think we are beginning to shift a little bit and saying, wow, we can look at an individual's strengths and we can use that. You know, if someone's very interested in, you know, math or, you know, someone who's really interested in vacuum cleaners, you know, knows everything about vacuum cleaners, how they work, how they come apart. Can we use that and can we, you know, use that to increase their literacy skills by reading more about vacuum cleaners instead of reading something that's not of interest to them? Can we increase social interaction by, you know, taking them to a vacuum cleaner shop and, you know, supporting interaction in that context? How can we sort of capitalize on those unusual or special interests instead of minimizing them because they are
in the efforts of more balance, right?
Right.
Interesting. Yeah. And what you're seeing is that can be effective.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's true for all of us, you know. You know, sometimes Shana and I joke our special interest is autism, right? So we get really excited when we're together and we're talking about autism, we're talking about our program, and that's, you know, our favorite, you know, one of our favorite topics. So it's true for all of us. We read about what we're interested in, we talk about what we're interested in.
And we would do that all day if we could.
So why limit people who are autistic? Right. How interesting. We're going to talk in just a moment a little bit more about what is happening at iSCAN is how you
iSPAN.
iSPAN is the shorthand at Nazareth for Shana and Dawn's work. But let me grab another phone call. This is Diana in Rochester. Diana, thanks for calling Connections. Go ahead.
Hi. I am a parent of two children in various places on the spectrum. I'm also a BCBA, so I've seen what's happened over the years and used a lot of the interventions over the years. My biggest concern is, two things. One is I think you're right to direct people toward their interests, but you need to also use that interest to teach and then generalize skills that they don't have. But the bigger problem that I see is that we expect the autistic individual to make all of the changes to fit into the neurotypical world, and we do not expect neurotypicals to make any changes at all.
Yep.
Absolutely. I think right on. You know, I think that that's so true. And so part of what we do in our program, you know, what we try to do is really inspire our students to think about their role as a professional in changing what's going on outside of the individual. So removing barriers, reducing barriers. So, you know, the role as a speech language pathologist or an educator or an occupational therapist is shifting, and it's no longer, you know, working with a child on increasing their writing skills or their verbal skills. That our role also is to work with the system in which that child lives. So work with other professionals in the school, work with the community, work with all the people in that child's circle of support to see how can we reduce barriers, how can we provide supports. Mm-hmm. We don't want to just change the person that has the label, in other words.
I think it goes even one step beyond. I think we need to educate from the ground up, from kindergarten to whatever environment someone with autism is in, that people who are neurotypical need to be educated about these are people now in their society. We do not any longer segregate many of the higher functioning. It's not true, obviously, it's not true across the board. Some are more profoundly affected and need different help. But for those who can and should attempt to be as independent as possible in this world, I mean, as a parent, I'm going to die someday, and my children have to be able to navigate this world.
Yes.
Can I just share a quick story that relates to this directly?
And so, by the way, Diana, thanks for the call. Go ahead.
Part of our program, in the final course in our program, the capstone course, we have the students complete a capstone project that is framed as a give back to the autism community. And one of our students who completed the course last semester, she is a teacher in a rural school district, and she created a program for her entire school that would allow her to go into classrooms and teach about neurodiversity. She actually introduced that vocabulary of neurodiversity, and she introduced the concept of autism, and did some really interactive things with the students to start, you know, exactly
planting
what
the
caller
seed.
Was saying, you know, really start planting the seed and framing it in a positive way. Like, because traditionally a lot of disability awareness programs and things might frame, you know, teaching about autism, like Billy might do this, you know, and that's different, but that's okay. And she really tried to frame it in more of a strength-based neurodiverse perspective. So,
well, and before we get back to the phones, and we're going to get back to the phones in just a second, Dawn and Shayna are the co-directors of the Interdisciplinary Specialty Program in Autism at Nazareth College. That prepares professionals across the lifespan. We're talking about, again, teaching or working with people all throughout their life with autism. And I'm curious to know about the interest in a program. iSpan gets what kind of interest now is there for people who want to become professionals who work with autistic people compared to 5, 10, 25 years ago?
So when the program began, our goal was to have 8 students in it. And so we began with an enrollment of 18. And
it began when? The program began?
It began last fall, 2013. Mm-hmm. Only 8 students were able to finish the entire sequence because many of us are participants are from multiple graduate programs and may or may not be able to fit all 3 courses in. And we also have practicing professionals from the community who are taking this course as well. And we always have a handful of those individuals who are interested in enhancing their own professional expertise. This fall, we have 29 individuals in that program. And so the interest is there. And we have individuals across professions such as music education, music therapy. We have a social worker. We have higher ed administration. We, of course, have a variety of inclusive educators. And we have speech-language pathologists. So it is across many areas that people are interested in developing this expertise.
The prevalence now 1 in 68. And there is obviously a demand for services, and at least now we're seeing an interest in filling them. Let's get back to the phones. This is Jenna in Pittsburgh. Go ahead, Jenna.
Hi, Adam. Thanks. My son has autism. As a parent, I have spoken to students at Nazareth, as my child has also participated in a program called SCAN through Autism Up and Nazareth, which has helped him in his speech-language capabilities. But I think for me and for my son in particular, one of the areas where I have seen the complete opposite of what's being discussed here is the education programs, and particularly Common Core, as it has now been adopted through our school districts, do not support our children on the spectrum at all.
No, they do not.
Especially if our children struggle with interpersonal language and social language skills or inferential language, et cetera. Common Core demands that they work in small groups, that they be able to speak to each other, that they make eye contact, that they have, that they work with these specific books. They can't work on their special interests as they were describing, vacuum cleaners, et cetera. Mm-hmm. My son can tell you everything there is to know about animals, reptiles, et cetera, but he struggles with language or words or social justice. So when he's reading books like Chains or Tom Sawyer or Huck Finn or things that have language like the N-word or mean words, he gets very upset and he doesn't understand why, if he's sitting next to an African-American student, they have to read those words. And he can have an outburst in class, and the teachers aren't prepared to work with him. And he may see his speech path twice a week for 15 minutes in a 5-1-1 group. That's not enough time for her to support him in the way he needs. So I think we really need to carry this forward, not just in speech language, but across the spectrum to help our kids be more successful and capable in the classroom.
Jenna, great call. You're getting a lot of nods here. Go ahead, Shannon.
Jenna, it is a great call. And you're right on about the Common Core. And again, you know, the Common Core learning standards are national standards that were adopted by New York State. They are state mandated. And there's also curricula that goes along with those. And in many districts, we're adopting the Engage New York curricula, which is a scripted curriculum for the Common Core learning standards. And what is just beginning to happen now, because again, remember that Common Core came in about 2 years ago into New York State. What's now starting to happen is that districts are realizing that many individuals are not able to fit into that nice little box of the Common Core and that they need to differentiate. And so it's going to take a little time, but I do believe that school districts need to be thinking about that. There are many articles out there about the mismatch of the Common Core Learning Standards curriculum with children on the autism spectrum, and we need to start paying attention to that.
Okay, so we can talk Common Core. We could probably do an hour just on
curriculum.
but let me start to kind of gear the last few minutes toward going forward, being productive. Again, not all of us will be in Sean and Dana, Dawn and Shana's, Sean and Dana, Dawn and Shana's program at Nazareth. But Dawn, give me a sense for, every time we talk autism on this program, there are parents who are frustrated that schools are coming along a little bit more slowly than maybe a lot of the rest of society in terms of understanding, integration, education. What are some things that you'd like to see schools focus on?
You know, I think that a lot of schools are doing some really great things, and it's all comes down to collaboration and that family-centered or person-centered way of thinking about support. So, you know, as professionals, as educators and SLPs, we need to listen to individuals like William, read, you know, what they have to say, ask them what they have to say. And even for very young children, you know, two-year-olds who are in early intervention, asking the parent, that's a core part of our practice, is asking parents, what is most important to you? What do you care most about this child that you've just found out has autism? You're, you know, struggling with it, has many needs. How can we meet you where you are, instead of like, oh, here's the recipe book for how to, you know, change your child or work with your family.
And that's a state thing, not a school's thing, really. Schools are mandated by the state to meet these requirements. So it really is our state, you know, puts these mandates on our schools.
William Evans, before I let you go, again, I want to thank you for taking the time to join us. You're in your mid-20s now. You're someone who has been so articulate this hour as you talk about autism. How have you seen changes in your own life? And I've only got 90 seconds or so, but changes in your own life in your mid-20s compared to, say, 10 years ago in terms of your own relationships and your own understanding of being autistic.
Well, I think that, first of all, I have a much more clear understanding of autistic traits. I have a much more clear understanding of sort of the autistic population. And I think that that's how many of us are. Many of us, the problem many of us face is we don't have an identity until we're older. And we think, oh, this is our deal. I see. Mm-hmm. And I think that if I could do it over again, I would want to have a much clearer identity of the things I did, things I said, and that's the way I operated at a much earlier age.
Mm-hmm. William, thank you for taking the time to join us this hour and share your perspective. And I know Dawn and Shana wanted you on this program for a reason, and we saw it this hour. It's been great to talk to you, and I appreciate your time.
I think you're welcome.
And, thanks, William.
And you know, for any parents, or especially for parents who get a new diagnosis, again, there's so many different things we could spend an hour talking about.
Bring us back. We'll talk some more with Gavin.
This conversation is not stopping here. And there are many voices in the autism community that we will certainly include as we move to include here.
Great.
But you hear someone like William Evans. That's a very impressive person. He's very clearly on his way to being very successful. He's got a great self-awareness. He's not afraid of his diagnosis. He understands it, and I think he's working within it to say, all right, now I've got a better grip on it. And that, to all of us, should say, instead of trying to push it aside, let's diagnose and let's understand more. I mean, that's just how I feel talking to William. What do you think, Shannon?
Yeah, I think that, I mean, William's just a remarkable young man in general, autism or not, right? And so I think it's very exciting, hopeful. That's why we brought him on. He always shows us something that we didn't see before. And that is why we enjoy talking with him. And he argues with us, and it's great. I love that
Andy
dialogue.
Andy has a wonderful sense of humor.
He sure does. Yeah.
Dawn, closing thoughts from you to share with our audience when it comes to just the way we work as a society and the way we've sort of made strides in autism.
I think that we should sort of always challenge ourselves to see things in a different way and think about things in a different way as professionals, as individuals living in society. Mm-hmm. Just how can we sort of flip our perspective a little bit?
And that's what you do at as co-directors of the Interdisciplinary Specialty Program in Autism at Nazareth College. Very interesting to hear how many different parts of our community end up in your classes there. And we're seeing the results. Shana, Dawn, thank you for taking the hour for us. And we will see you again.
Thank you.
Thank you, Evan.
There's no question about that. This is part of our Move to Include series. Our thanks to the Golisano Foundation, a partnership with WXXI News. And our thanks to our wonderful, intrepid engineers, Randy Gorbman, Juan Vasquez. Great stuff. Thanks, guys. I'm Evan Dawson. This is Connections on member-supported public radio.